Amen. Okay, so we got through to 9, 7, or 8 last time. Let's kind of build up to there. Again, as we've noted again and again, the Hebrew writer is writing to a group of Jewish converts to Christianity who have, for some time now, wherever they may be, they have been facing persecution, and there are some indications in the book that may suggest that that persecution is becoming more severe. And they are tempted to fall back into their old way of life, fall back to Judaism, and leave the Lord. And the Hebrew writer is writing to them from a theological perspective to show them that Jesus is vastly, vastly, immeasurably superior to what they left in Judaism. So he's making that argument, but he also pauses at various points in the midst of that argument to make practical application and say, don't shrink back to destruction, essentially, to use the Hebrew writer's own language. Don't leave the Lord, because that will be a fatal error. It will be a fatal error along the lines of what the Israelites did in the wilderness. You will not make it to the rest that God has promised. And so he starts out, Jesus is better than the angels, and because he's better than the angels, his message is better than their message. They were the ones through whom the old covenant was mediated. Jesus is the one through whom the new covenant is mediated. And if their words prove steadfast, how much more the message that comes from God himself in the person of Jesus Christ. Jesus is superior to Moses and Joshua. And as a result, Moses was faithful in God's house. Jesus built God's house. Moses was a servant. Jesus is a son. Joshua led the people into a temporal rest, a type of eternal rest. But Jesus is leading men to the very rest that God, his Father, entered into on the seventh day, the eternal rest. And for some time now, we've been dealing with this idea of Jesus' superiority to the Levitical priests and his emphasis on that. He says in 4:14, we have such a great high priest. He spends a little bit of time talking about that in chapter 5 and points out that Jesus has been appointed by God. He was appointed through a promise and not according to the law. Then he sort of breaks off in the midst of that discussion, and he chastens them a little bit. He says, "We have much to say, but it's hard to explain because you have become dull of hearing." And though you should by now be teachers, we're having to explain the elementary principles of the oracles of God. And so you need to bring it up a little bit. But then he goes on to say, "But we're confident of better things concerning you, things concerning salvation." And after this practical application, this practical exhortation, he returns to the idea of Jesus being a priest according to the order of Melchizedek in chapter 7. And he reminds us of the priesthood of Melchizedek, and that something about Melchizedek, he was without father, without mother, without genealogy. And so he was an everlasting priest without beginning or end. And he points out that the priesthood, according to the order of Melchizedek, is superior to the Levitical priesthood. And a greater priest has a greater covenant. He makes that point in 7:12 when he says, when the priesthood is changed of necessity, there takes place a change of the law also. And then he talks about the new covenant in chapter 8 that God has promised. He points out that the high priest that we have is a minister in a sanctuary in the true tabernacle, not the one pitched by men. So not an earthly tabernacle, but the actual dwelling place of God. He points out that the tabernacle on earth was a copy and a shadow of the heavenly things. And Jesus is a minister in heaven. And then he sort of returns this idea that he introduced in 7:12 that about the new covenant. And he quotes Jeremiah 31:31-34. And he points out as soon as Jeremiah said new covenant, what's that mean about the old covenant? Yeah, it's going away. It's passing away. It's becoming obsolete and growing old and ready to disappear. And then last time we kind of did a deep dive into the first, maybe not that deep a dive, but we looked at in some detail the first few verses of chapter 9. And this is sort of based on the Day of Atonement. And we noted a couple of weeks ago that the first sacrifice that Aaron offers is for whom? For himself, which is an immediate contrast to Jesus' priesthood after the order of Melchizedek. Does Jesus offer a sacrifice for himself? Why not? He was the sacrifice, okay, but he doesn't need it. Right. No sin. Point the Hebrew writers made at this point made several times. And of course the Levitical priests are making atonement, and we'll say more about this in just a moment. They are cleansing physical things. It's outward sorts of things. I want to talk more about the place the Day of Atonement occupies in the development of the thinking in Leviticus in just a minute. But there's that, and the fact that the Day of Atonement happens how often? Yeah, once a year. And so year after year after year, and the very repetition of that is an indication it didn't take care of the problem. Jesus offered one sacrifice for all times. We talked some about the various aspects of the tabernacle and how that speaks to the fact that the way into the presence of God was not manifest as long as the tabernacle was standing. And that's kind of where we left off. In verse 8, the Holy Spirit is signifying this, that the way into the holy place has not yet been disclosed while the outer tabernacle is still standing. So as long as this arrangement, of course the tabernacle is not standing anymore, but this arrangement is still an active principle, that's a declaration from the Spirit of God that the way into the holy place, the way into the direct presence of God, is still problematic. Because who can go into the holy place? Only the high priest. Only the high priest. And how often? Once a year. And we talked about the fact that even then he sort of carries a barrier with him, because what went before him when he went in there? Yeah, the censer with the incense. I can't actually hear anything you're saying. I'm just assuming you're saying what I hope you're saying. So you're kind of getting the benefit of the doubt here. So yeah, so they carry this barrier that would actually cover the mercy seat and the one who dwelt above the mercy seat, the one who dwells above the cherubim. to stand as a bearer. And the whole thing is a towering testimony to the fact that man is not worthy to come into the presence of God. And it makes that point over and over and over again. And so as long as this is still an active principle, then there is not a way into the presence of God. He says, he describes this as a symbol. There we go. As a symbol for the present time. And gifts and sacrifices are offered which cannot make the worshiper perfect. How? In conscience. They cannot make the worshiper perfect in conscience. Because he says they relate only to food and drink and various washings, regulations for the body imposed until the time of Reformation. Now I want to think about this statement for just a moment. And think about what that means, what that says about the old law. Let's turn back to Leviticus for a moment. Maybe more than a moment. Okay, so quick outline of the first part of Leviticus. 1 through 7 has to do with sacrifices. And the five sacrifices, the burnt offering, the grain offering, the peace offering, the sin offering, and the guilt offering. And then after covering those five sacrifices, it talks about the priest's portion of those sacrifices and how they're to handle that. In the latter part of that section, the first seven chapters. And so, sacrificial laws in 1 through 7. And then 8 through 10, we have the ordination of the priests, where they are cleansed and sanctified and set apart to their purpose. And of course, you have the narrative in chapter 10 of Nadab and Abihu offering strange fire before the Lord. And then in 11 through 15... we have a series of laws that sort of meet this description. They relate only to food and drink and various washings and regulations for the body. So outward uncleanness. And we're just going to look at a little bit of this in chapter 11. Starting in verse 2, he says, "Speak to the sons of Israel, these are the creatures which you may eat from all the animals which are on the earth. Whatever divides the hoof, making split hooves and chews the cud, among the animals you may eat." And then he says, "You're not to eat of those which chew the cud or among those which divide the hoof. The camel, for though it chews the cud, it does not divide the hoof." And he talks about all these unclean animals. And he tells them the purpose of these. Okay? He tells them the purpose of these laws. And it's not hygiene, by the way. He says in verse 45 of chapter 11, "I am the Lord who brought you up from the land of Egypt to be your God. You shall be holy, for I am holy. This is the law regarding the animal and the bird and every living thing that moves in the waters and everything that swarms on the earth, to make a distinction between the unclean and the clean, between the edible creature and the creature which is not to be eaten." And so they are to learn some lessons about holiness. That's the purpose of those laws. They're an object lesson in holiness. And then there are some laws about birthing children in chapter 12. And then there are laws about leprosy in 13 and in 14, various kinds of leprosy, and not just skin diseases, but even what leprosy in a house, probably mildew or something like that. And then there are all kinds of regulations in chapter 15 about all kinds of bodily emissions. I know that you would like to discuss that in greater detail, but we're going to pass over that for now. But then, so you have all of these sort of outward things in Leviticus 11 through 15. They all have the same purpose. to teach the Israelites all object lessons in holiness. But then you have the Day of Atonement. And basically what the Day of Atonement says is you got all these people who are encountering all this uncleanness, and then they're inevitably, even though they have all kinds of laws for cleansing and that sort of thing, they're inevitably bringing some of that uncleanness with them when they come up into the presence of the Lord, into the tabernacle. And so every year, the tabernacle has to be cleansed. And that's the Day of Atonement. And so it's the Day of Atonement in Leviticus 16 is an answer to the problem implied in Leviticus 11 through 15. Okay, and that's what the Hebrew writer is talking about here. Does that make sense? I'm not asking if you agree with me. I'm just asking if I'm being clear. Okay. Okay, good. So there's that. Now let's look at Numbers 19, which the Hebrew writer specifically refers to. We haven't gotten there yet, but he's about to refer to Numbers 19. And it has another practice, another sacrifice that involves cleansing that was prescribed in the law. In Numbers 19:2, this is the statute of the law which the Lord has commanded, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel, that they bring you an unblemished red heifer in which is no defect and on which a yoke has never been placed. You shall give it to Eleazar the priest. It shall be brought outside the camp and be slaughtered in his presence. Next, Eleazar the priest shall take some of its blood with his finger and sprinkle some of the blood toward the front of the tent of meeting seven times." So they sacrifice this heifer. They take some of the blood of the heifer. They're outside the camp, of course, when they're doing this. And they sprinkle it toward the tabernacle in the direction of the tabernacle. And then they burn it, verse 5. They burn the heifer. They burn all the heifer. The blood and everything is all burned up. And they throw in some cedar wood and hyssop and scarlet material. And then the ashes are stored outside the camp. And then the ashes, on the occasions that he goes on to specify, are mixed with water. And that water is used to cleanse people who have come in contact with something that's defiled them, like a dead body. Okay, he goes on in verse 11 and following. He talks about those who touch a corpse. And he goes on to explain how to apply this. But again, it was for outward cleansing, as the Hebrew writer has said. These things relate to outward things. Various washings, regulations for the body, imposed until a time of reformation. Now, what's the time of reformation? What's he pointing to? Christ. Exactly so. He's pointing to Jesus, who is the fulfillment of all this. And I want to look at, before we go back to Hebrews, I want to look at one more passage. Matthew chapter 15. Matthew chapter 15. Where Jesus makes a point about referencing some of these kinds of things. In Matthew chapter 15 and verse 11, he says, "It is not what enters into the mouth that defiles the man, but what proceeds out of the mouth. This defiles the man." And so Jesus says, look, it's not about eating something unclean or eating something with unclean hands, in this case, the context of Matthew 15. That's not what defiles you. It's not about coming in contact with something. Now, the disciples don't understand that. And so if you drop down to verse 15, Peter says, "Explain the parable to us." And Jesus says in verse 17, "Do you not understand that everything that goes into the mouth passes through the stomach and is eliminated? But the things that proceed out of the mouth come from the heart. Those defile the man, for out of the heart come evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witnesses, slanders. These are the things which defile the man. But to eat with unwashed hands does not defile the man. And so Jesus and the Hebrew writer are pointing to something very important. You can be ceremonially clean and have a defiled conscience. Okay? Those things did not address the problem, which is internal and spiritual, not external and physical. Okay? They're a symbol of the solution, but they are not themselves the solution. They point to the problem, but they don't themselves solve the problem. And so the Hebrew writer says that it is the sacrifice of Christ that is going to actually deal with this. He says in verse 11, when Christ appeared as a high priest of the good things to come, he entered through the greater and more perfect tabernacle. Okay? And so, and what tabernacle did Christ enter into? What tabernacle is Christ ministering in? The one in heaven. The real one. The actual one. The one that was the pattern from which the one that Moses built was made. It was the real thing. Moses' tabernacle was a model, if you will, of a spiritual reality. Jesus entered into the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands. That is to say, not of this creation. And so he entered into the actual presence of God. And also, not through the blood of goats and calves, but through his own blood. Now, think about that a minute. Why is human blood, or divine blood, actually both, I guess, better than the blood of bulls and goats, or bulls and calves? Why was it goats and calves? Why is it better? Why is blood not blood? Okay, he is made after the image of God. Let's think about a few things. So when the priests were getting ready to offer a sacrifice, did they sort of line up all of the unblemished goats and calves and say, okay, who wants to be the sacrifice today? Is that what happened? Did the calves and goats do this of their own free will for the good of God's people? Well, no, of course not. They are dumb, literally, dumb sacrifices. They have no knowledge or understanding of what they are doing. Jesus purposed to be a sacrifice. He knew he was going to be a sacrifice. Before he was a sacrifice, he chose to be a sacrifice. And so his sacrifice is in fact greater because it is an act of will. And of course, they are unblemished in a physical sense, but goats and calves cannot either be with or without sin because, again, they're dumb. Jesus is unblemished in a way that a calf or goat never can be. They can be whole. They can, you know, they can have all that. A calf can have all the attributes that a calf is supposed to have, and it can have them to the degree that they're supposed to have them. But that's, again, that's physical. Jesus, as Alan has just pointed out, is in the image of God. He is without blemish in that essential spiritual and moral way, without sin every attribute and purpose of God fully and perfectly realized. They're temporal. He's eternal. I mean, you can go on and on and on and on. They're just a symbol. But they were. Jesus is so much more than that. Now, the other thing we see is he entered the holy place once for all, having obtained eternal redemption. Now, again, let's think about this. The word redemption is a term that is roughly equivalent to our word ransom. And it literally means the price of loosing. Okay, so it was a price paid. It was a price paid to set slaves free from their captivity. It was a price paid to set prisoners of war free from their captivity. It was sometimes used of a slave being purchased by a pagan god. It was essentially the price goes through the temple, I guess, to the slave owner, and then the slave goes is dedicated to the god. He offers some acts of piety and is set free. And so there's that kind of thing went on in the ancient world. But it's always a price of loosing. Now, again, let's think about. Are the consequences of sin temporal or eternal? They're eternal. Okay? So, an adequate sacrifice or an adequate price paid must then be temporal or eternal. It's got to be eternal. It's got to be eternal. There's got to be an eternal price paid. There's got to be an eternal sacrifice made. And so he entered the holy place once for all. One sacrifice obtained eternal redemption. It has eternal implications, because the one who sacrificed himself was temporal or eternal? Eternal. Eternal. And so that is of immense importance, that there was an eternal price paid. And I don't know. I'm going to throw this out. I can't get my arms around this. I don't make any claim to fully understanding it. But my belief is that Jesus' sacrifice on the cross has eternal implications for him. That is, he forever stands before God as a slaughtered lamb because of what he did on the cross. Now, what does that mean? I have no idea. Okay, I don't claim to fully grasp that. But I do believe that there are eternal implications for Jesus Christ, that he paid an eternal price, and that does, in fact, have eternal implications for him. Not that he's less God or anything like that. That's not what I'm saying. But that it's not only a moment in time, but there are implications of that sacrifice that will always be true. Any thoughts or comments on that? Anybody want to clarify that or add to it? Or nobody's wading in, huh? Alan, go ahead.
The incarnation has
Yeah. Right, we can't really grasp who he was before, and so it's hard for us to quantify, and we can't quantify. You can't quantify God. Period. And so he stands before God as an intercessor, as a sacrifice, as a high priest. And all of that is a result of... And so let us not... The reason I bring this up is because I don't want us to think that, you know, Jesus kind of came to earth and he slummed it down here for a little while to get us out of the mess we're in. And then he went back to heaven and that's done with, and that's... It's more than that. Now, how much more, what all that means, I don't know. But what I do know from this passage, what this passage at least hints at, is that in some sense, the cost to Jesus Christ has eternal implications for us and for Him. And the fact that He would do that for us just makes His love and mercy and redemptive purpose even bigger. And that, I think, is what the Hebrew writer is trying to get them to see. Yeah, that old system, that was amazing. It was great. He's not knocking that. But it doesn't touch top side or bottom of what Jesus Christ has done. It's not even... It's just... It's a rough... chalk sketch of the reality that is in Jesus Christ. And that's what he's trying to drive home. In 13 and 14, he begins to talk about what we looked at in Numbers 19. Okay? He says, if the blood of goats and bulls and the ashes of a heifer, sprinkling those who have been defiled, sanctify for the cleansing of the flesh, the outward, what we looked at in Leviticus and Numbers, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God? Jesus cleansing us. The gospel works on us not from the outside in, but from the inside out. And it is the knowledge that our sins are forgiven and the knowledge that the character and nature of God can be realized in us that allows for a radical change that didn't happen under the law. Not that it wasn't intended, not God was trying to change people then too, and there was mercy and grace then too, but it was pointing to something greater. Okay? And the fact is that we can be cleansed on the inside now. Our consciences can be cleansed. And of course, Peter talks about baptism as an appeal to God or an answer for a good conscience. Appeal to God for a good conscience, which can be realized through Jesus Christ. But the fact that the sacrifice on the Day of Atonement were offered over and over and over again, reminded them of what? They're not good conscience. That's what it reminded them of. It reminded them of their not good conscience. That's been taken care of. Thoughts? Comments? Before Kelly hits the bell here. Right. To serve the living God in a new way, too, because now in the old system, there's a separation. Okay? But now, as he's going to say when it gets later on down into chapter 10, we come boldly into the presence of God. Now, our boldness is not boldness in ourselves. Our boldness is in the boldness of the efficacy of the sacrifice and the efficacy of the high priest. And so that service to God is transformed and becomes something newer and greater than it ever has been before in the new covenant. Any thoughts? Comments? Kelly, oh, there it is. Thought maybe it wasn't going to ring enough. Just again. All right, thank you. We'll pick up in 9:15 next time.